Here's a complex issue for the modern democratic state. Dealing with COVID-19 will require effective monitoring and tracing, surveillance, if you will, especially as we move into this next phase of containment. That's clearly action aimed at a public good, diminishing the impact of the disease. But what's the balance we strike with individual freedom, with privacy? At what point does the sort of surveillance needed to stop the spread of a disease cross over into interference, perhaps even authoritarian control? COVID-19, it is testing these limits. What's the point of balance? Dr. Nicholas Wright is a medical doctor and neuroscientist, works on emerging tech and global strategy at Intelligent Biology in the UK. He's also an affiliated scholar, Georgetown University, a cybersecurity fellow at New America Foundation, author of an interesting piece in last week's Foreign Affairs magazine. He joins us from London. Nicholas, welcome to LNL.
Hi, very good to be on. Thank you.
You write in Foreign Affairs that we live at a moment of overlap and what you call two global disruptions, the epidemiological and the technological. And they will, you say, shape the next few years of global history. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, now, literally today, everybody thinks COVID is changing everything. So you think about the economic impacts, you think about the political impacts, geopolitical impacts. Clearly, COVID is going to have huge effects on the history of the next few years. But if we think back just 8 weeks or so, certainly in countries like Britain or America or Australia, I imagine as well, what a lot of people were thinking was going to change the world, and what a lot of people were thinking was going to be critical in shaping the next few years of global history, was artificial intelligence, digital technologies. So you have the huge tech giants from the US, you have the huge tech giants from China, you have the creation of a digital authoritarian state in China, the ability to conduct considerable and very sophisticated surveillance on the population in China. And that's what everyone was really worried about 8 weeks ago. So now all of that is still true, right? None of that's gone away. It is certainly true that hundreds of millions of people around the world are going to lose their jobs because of AI and automation and digitization. Yep. And they're going to have to move into other jobs, for example. Now, the question then is, how does the world-changing event of COVID dovetail with the world-changing impacts of AI and the digital technologies? And that's really what I'm most interested in at the moment.
Is that a perfect storm that's benign, or is that a faintly sort of malignant conjunction?
I mean, I think it's one of those things where it is impossible to say at the moment exactly how things are going to pan out. There are too many variables. There are epidemiological variables, there are economic variables, there are political variables, and there are technological variables. That there's too much to say, but we can say a few things that are almost certain to be true, if there is such a thing as truth. So one thing is just the nature of public health. So the nature of public health since the 1850s, you see classic public health cases. John Snow, everyone who went to medical school in Australia, I'm sure everyone who goes to medical school in Britain or America, we will all learn about John Snow, who basically used data. So this was the most famous case in public health, and he used data to identify cases of cholera in the London district of Soho, so a mile or so from my medical school. And he used data, he carefully pinpointed where cases appeared of cholera. And by putting them all on a map, identifying them, using his data, he identified there was a particular water pump that was the source of a key outbreak of cholera. He used surveillance and detective work, and he went, spoke to people, patrolled the area, etc., etc. And then he got the local authorities to remove the handle of that water pump, and that, and simultaneous with that, that there was a marked reduction in deaths from this outbreak of cholera. This is what John Snow did, and really, the idea of surveillance being central to public health is something that we've seen with every generation since that 19th century origin of modern public health. And all they do is they just use new technologies.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, and John Snow is such a fascinating example in this context, because what he did was essentially highly localized. What he did there was sort of a community action. We make this assumption about surveillance and surveillance technology that it has to be this statewide overview, that it's a mechanism of the total state. Can it not be done in more that sort of John Snow way, more owned by a community?
No. It's a simple answer. So how did he, I mean, to give you the exact example of John Snow, now, we can have a whole discussion about the history and whether the removal of the pump handle, physically removing the handle of the pump that was the source of the outbreak.
Well, he ought not get caught on the pump.
ordinary people can't just decide to remove a pump handle for drinking water that people rely on for their drinking water. You know, that was the local authorities who agreed that, you know, to remove the pump handle. So often the interventions you have to take are serious interventions, and they require democratic or certainly legitimate governmental oversight, and that has to happen with the states. Once we get to, so surveillance carries on, you know, each generation since John Snow in the 1850s, each generation has used more and more and more powerful methods of surveillance. Now we have enormously powerful methods of surveillance. We're talking about surveilling the entire, to use a horrible Americanism, surveilling the entire population of Australia, for example, right, in extreme detail using digital means. If you're going to do that, that requires democratic oversight, because the power that gives the state, or, you know, if you wanted it to be random civil society, that's fine. The power it gives whoever you give that power to is enormous.
How does that get, though, that democratic oversight? And how does that democratic oversight come with authority? I mean, if the state is collecting who knows what, and there are good reasons why the state might not reveal the extent of what it's collecting in terms of information and surveillance, how then is the oversight effective?
I mean, I think that the best answer is just look at history in successful, rich, developed democracies like Britain or the United States or Sweden, for example, over the last couple of centuries. So what you see there is a huge expansion, a huge proliferation of surveillance capabilities from the state, from things like academia, from the private sector and so on. A vast proliferation of surveillance has occurred. Just to give you one example, police forces, we take it as natural that there will be a police force now in Sydney or Melbourne or London or wherever. That was not the case. So it was in the 1820s that the Metropolitan Police was set up in London. And there was a huge debate about whether or not you could have would this end up being a secret police along the lines of continental Europe? And so what you had was the setting up of a police service that was consistent with the character of a free country. That was the famous phrase at the time. And so we massively enhanced surveillance capabilities of the state, and simultaneously we built in democratic and legitimate safeguards. And there is no reason, we've done it for the last 200 years, there's no reason why we can't do it for these new technologies.
There's the parallel discussion here, which we ought not distract us, about how so much information is now corporatized, and the collection of surveillance information is in fact not so much done by the state as by big corporate entities. But let's go to the gold standard in state surveillance, which is probably China. Tell us about grid management.
About what, sorry? About
the grid management surveillance system.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, I think that, so again, this is not new. So I think that it's really important to realize that a lot of what is happening in China, a lot of what's happening in Australia or Britain or America or China or France, it is just a consequence of the way that our states and our societies are set up. And so in China, China is fundamentally a Marxist-Leninist communist state. It's a bit more complicated than that, clearly, with reform and opening from the 1980s and so on. But they still have the sinews. It is fundamentally an authoritarian state, and they have the sinews of an authoritarian state. And so, for example, when you have the challenge of monitoring behavior, taking temperatures, monitoring, making sure people aren't leaving their houses, all that kind of stuff, the type of stuff that you might want to do in a public health emergency like COVID, they can call upon an extensive network of local committees and groups. And what they can also do is they can then apply a grid management system on top of that. So this has got, you know, this has been around for decades. It's just a standard, you know, Leninist thing. What you do is you divide the country or the area you're interested in controlling into little geographical areas, and then you put a person in charge of that area. So you put a grid over it, and then you manage each of the cells within that grid. And they control those, they help coordinate all those local committees. And you know, well over a million grid workers were sent out to control lots of these little parcels of humanity within China that they were concerned about. And then they could control what happened within those areas.
You now equip that with incredibly sophisticated technology, and you get a very effective system of community oversight, shall we say.
Exactly. And the thing is that that's not, you know, again, this is the thing. There are huge upsides of surveillance. So a lot of the success of the, you know, of the British state in child protection or public health or whatever the other things you want to say, and the same thing in America, Australia, that's the huge upsides of surveillance. And in China, they, you know, there are upsides of surveillance. There are also downsides. And, you know, in a democratic society, we want to balance the upsides along with the downsides.
So, and what happens in a democratic society is that we have a relationship which is fundamentally built on trust. And I guess that's where we're entering now as we marshal surveillance and technology against COVID-19. We need to trust the governments implementing those measures.
No, exactly. We need to trust, you know, and I think broadly, I know that it's very fashionable to say that there is no trust in government and so on. Yes, clearly trust has gone down, but fundamentally, you know, we do still trust the government. Like, you know, it's all well and good saying there's no trust in government, but yes, you trust the dollar in your pocket. You trust the doctors on the whole to keep if you go along with an embarrassing medical problem, they will, with any luck, keep that confidential. You trust them to do so. And the same with a wide variety of other types of data, tax information and so on that we give to governments and other bodies.
But as a community, we're sort of entering a moment, aren't we, in this pandemic where we're going to have to make this compact, because to reduce the rate of infection, to perhaps take communities to zero, that's going to require pretty rigorous monitoring of people within those communities. That's necessary.
Yeah. And I think the other, as I said, it's like the John Snow case is a good example. So classic public health rests on surveillance. Right, that you just cannot get away from that. It rests on surveillance of populations, and then implementing behavioural changes and modifying their behaviour. That is the essence of public health. So now, COVID-19 is a public health problem. So the question is not whether we will have increased surveillance. That's not the question. The question is not whether we, not if, but how we're going to do the surveillance. And I think there's a really important point as well. If I could just add an extra point here. Which is that COVID is not flu. Okay. Now, if you'd asked me 2 years ago, what's the pandemic that could kill tens of millions of people that we should all be worried about? I'd have said flu, right? Like everybody else.
Yep.
Pretty much. I'd have said flu. Now,
COVID
isn't flu. but no, this isn't super. This is the point. This isn't super flu. We could still have a global flu pandemic in 2024, 2025. Right. Yep. When in 12 months time, when we're, you know, 18 months time, when we're hopefully out of the worst of the COVID issue. Right. Somebody's going to turn around and say we could have exactly the same thing with flu. Right. And flu is not exactly the same as COVID. So that will require slightly different measures as well. And so how are we going to put in place surveillance measures, the reserve surveillance capabilities we need in Britain and Australia and America and wherever, to combat that potential flu problem we're going to have in 2025 or 2030. So yes. The question is not just how we deal with the surveillance now, but how we build the reserve surveillance capabilities we're going to need that will be demanded politically and understandably so, to deal with the next potential COVID or the next potential global flu pandemic.
What a cheery picture you paint, Nicholas.
It's all right. It's my pleasure. But then that's the historical point, though. We've done this before. You know, it's not that bad. Don't worry about it. You know, we've done this before. Australia's a nice place to live, you know. And you have extreme surveillance by the standards of, like, you know, of 200 years ago. So don't worry about it. We've done it before.
We should relax and stop flinching at the word. Nicholas, thank you for those words of both alarm and reassurance, both. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Dr. Nicholas Wright, article in the April 6 version of Foreign Affairs magazine. Have a look at that. Some interesting ideas in there. This is Late Night Live.